Laura, do you know what would make this podcast even more fun, even cooler, perhaps even more unhinged?
Ooh, what?
If we did it live together in person at my church.
Sign me up.
This is me asking you to be my prom date. And by that, I mean, this is me asking you to come to Austin, Texas, because on May 11th, Saturday, May 11th at 3 p.m. Central Time at Jubilee Episcopal Church, which is at 12129 FM 620. You can also find us on Google Maps and Apple Maps. Mother Peaches is descending to Jubilee.
Woo!
Beside myself.
Yes, everyone. It's true. We are doing a live event and there are many ways to participate. So if you would like to come join us at that time, we would love to have you. We will be recording, I believe, two Q&A episodes. One will be for our main feed. One will be for our Patreon subscribers. So you can join our Patreon community to support this podcast if you would like access to that content and to support our podcast. Thank you.
Yes,
and
please.
Then also we will be, I don't know, we've got some tricks up our sleeves. Well, you have a trick, but we're thinking games. We're thinking, I don't know, all sorts
fun
of
surprises,
fun. All
audience
sorts of
participation.
Fun. Yes,
some like
yes.
Jimmy Fallon style late night ridiculousness.
Yeah, just some fun to celebrate with each other. And so we'll have some fun, and then we'll walk across. Is it across the street?
It's literally across the street. Yeah,
we'll walk across the street to
Slackers Brewing,
Jubilee parishioner owned brewery with non-alcoholic options, vegan food, all sorts of good stuff, just to hang out.
Yeah. So 3 p.m. Saturday, May 11th. And if you're still in town and you want to come to church at Jubilee on Sunday, May 12th, which also happens to be Mother's Day, Laura's going to be preaching and I'm going to be celebrating. So it's going to be a really fun time. Would love to. I don't know if the Episcopal universe can handle us being in the same space, but we'll find out.
Yes. So please join us. We'd love to have you join us in person or just enjoy the content online.
And it will be streamed live on the Jubilee YouTube page also.
Yes. So there are many ways to join us and we hope you will. So see you all in May.
Bye. Hey, Laura.
Hey, Lizzie.
The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Friends, I'm the Reverend Lizzie McManus-Dale.
And I'm the Reverend Laura DePamphilo. And welcome to And Also With You,
a new podcast on reclaiming an ancient Christian faith for modern Christian life.
Hello, everyone.
Happy Easter.
Happy Easter, or whatever time of the year it is when you're listening.
Yeah.
This episode is being broadcasted in the Easter season, so we hope it's full of blessings and joy and celebration for you. Today, we thought we would log on and answer some of the questions we have asked you all for. We are doing another mailbag episode, a little less structured and formal than some of our other recent episodes, but we just get so many great questions. So we thought we would take some time to answer them.
Yeah. So right off the top, first question we got is, what translations or versions of the Bible would you recommend for a progressive Christian or someone who's like new to reading scripture? And I'll share that my favorite translation to start with is the Common English Bible. And the reason I like the Common English Bible is, one, the most diverse body of scholars basically ever to translate like a big official free translation. Like, you can go anywhere online, BibleGateway.com. You know, you have to pay for a Bible if you buy it from like a Barnes and Noble, but the most diverse body of scholars ever translated the Common English Bible translation. And so I just really cherish that. And I also cherish that the Common English Bible is written in genuine common vernacular English. It's graded at an 8th grade reading level, which most English translations are at least a 12th grade reading level. And I'm not saying that adults only read at an 8th grade reading level, although some adults do. I actually just think that what we proclaim in worship, I want it to be accessible to as many people as possible. And frankly, even though I have 3 freaking degrees in religion, when I'm trying to like decipher things like what Paul says, when you get like really in the nitty gritty of like 2 Corinthians and stuff like that, I'm like, give me the Common English Bible, like give it to me plain. And they also make some cool translation choices. Like, instead of saying the Son of Man, they say the Human One. And there's some really great study Bibles out there that are CEB. So CEB is my personal endorsement. Laura, what about you?
Similar. I love the Common English Bible. Commonly in worship, we will read the NRSV. Well, there's an updated version. So now it's the NRSVUE. And
that's what I'm using similar. In my book a lot.
Yeah, it's great. Similar. I mean, it has a diverse kind of contributor list. I think theologically, I like a lot of the decisions they make with translations. I think we talked about this a little bit in our Bible episode, although that was like 100 years ago. So I don't know. But I know we've talked about how every translation is an interpretation in some ways, and that the translators have to make decisions about how to translate the text. And so it's just the kind of thought process that went into it. I just have come to trust and appreciate. And it's the version that maybe if you go to an Episcopal church, you'll most commonly hear read from the pulpit, from the lectern rather. So it's a good one. My kind of controversial take is that I really like the Message. Some people think it's like really cringe, and it is. If you read some of the poetry of the Bible, doesn't really translate very well in the Message. Sure. But what I appreciate about it is, you know, if you've been in church or if you've read the Bible before or encountered it, you know, we have all these wonderful stories, and sometimes you hear them over and over again. And to hear it in a really more modern translation is just some of the choices that were made reveal new things to me.
Yeah.
They make me think differently about stories I've heard a million times. And sometimes it's not so, I mean, modern. I should actually look up when they compiled the Message. It's not like terribly recent, but so some of it now feels a little outdated in kind of funny ways, but I do really like it. And so, you know, if you're thinking about looking at several different versions, why not look at the Message as well?
Yeah.
It's kind of my thought.
Which was translated by Eugene Peterson. And I'm looking it up right now. Published in segments from 1993 to 2002. So in the scope of like 2000 years of Christian history, it's pretty recent. But it's also as recent as like, our God is an awesome God.
Yeah. All right, stop singing. We don't have the rights to that, Lizzie. I'm not trying to.
Oh my God. Sorry.
No, I'm just kidding.
I will also offer my offering for a singular person's translation of scripture that I reference all the time. I love, if you've been around a while, you know who I'm going to say, the Reverend Dr. Will Gaffney. She is an incredible womanist Hebrew Bible scholar. She's not written like a whole translation of the Bible, but the books I recommend are Womanist Midrash, which is especially if you're like, wow, the Old Testament feels really foreign and hard. Read that, babe. Read it. It's so good. And I think she does the thing that I admire really deeply in scholars who understand that their work is not just for the academy and that she writes for people to read who don't necessarily have an MDiv. I just really admire that about her. And she has is compiling a 3-year cycle of the lectionary, which is what the lectionary is. It's a 3-year cycle of readings that gets you through basically the entirety of the Gospels and a little bit of the Old Testament and all the Psalms. And she's done this project called a Women's Lectionary for the whole church, which we have done periodically at Jubilee with the bishop's permission. And it's been transformative as a preacher. Translating is incredible. She pays really particular attention to the gender in the grammar, especially in the Hebrew, and reveals that like there's so much, like her translation of Genesis 1 was, in the beginning, she, the spirit, moved over the deep, because ruach, which is the Hebrew for spirit, is feminine. It's a feminine word. And I've never seen that in an English translation, like show the gendering of the nouns into English. And so that's really cool. And she just offers really interesting commentary. If you are like, wow, I've never heard of this passage from Zephaniah or whatever. Mm-hmm. I think that's, you know, when you're diving into the Bible, I mean, the biggest thing is read it with people, read it with other people. And if that's not accessible to you, reading it with other people vis-a-vis reading it with other biblical scholars or a study Bible is a great way to start.
Yes.
So those are some translations we like.
Those are. And we got another question, and it was a good one that we'll just try to knock out kind of quickly. But someone asked, do you ever use the older editions of the Book of Common Prayer? Why or why not?
And Laura's like, absolutely not. And I'm like, heck yes.
I don't really have like anything that deep to say. I've read them, I've compared them, I've been to worship services with them. There are a few parishes, I don't know how many, across the country that still will use the 28 prayer book. For me, I mean, it's so funny because like even the 79 at this point, like
it's old.
It's not that new. You know, that's
literally
fine.
55 years old.
Yeah, it's like, it's enough. I mean, we also do Enriching Our Worship and some of the other offerings from the Episcopal Church that aren't the prayer book. So I use those a lot more than I never use anything other than older than the 79. That's what I'll say. So I don't really have anything that deep to say, except for the fact that they just don't speak to me. I think it's cool if they speak to you and fuel your faith. It's just not been my experience. Lizzie?
I have a personal passion project that has to do with the BCP prior to 1979. And that is this rite, this, I would argue, sacramental rite, but it's never presented as a sacrament. So that's a Lizzie opinion, not a BCP Book of Common Prayer mandate, called the Thanksgiving of Women After Childbirth, commonly called the Churching of Women, which is something that's still practiced in Catholic and Orthodox parishes. And I am on a one-woman campaign to bring it back in the Episcopal Church, which was transformed in the 70s into the prayer, the service that you can find in the 1979 Book of Common Prayer called the Thanksgiving After the Birth or Adoption of a Child, and reflective of a lot of the obstetric and cultural shift at that time, as it shifted the emphasis away from giving thanks for the woman or the person who's given birth to the child. And I think that's great. And I think I love that it's a more inclusive view of family to include adoption and see that, you know, not mm-hmm. every family is made through birth and not every birth is a happy experience, etc. But I grieve that we cut this, because the Churching of Women was in every single prayer book up until the 1979 prayer book. And it was a very simple prayer service that basically, you know, we'll do a whole episode on this at some point, because I'll make Laura do it with me because I love it so much. But
yeah, we really should.
Honestly, it's so fascinating, because it was the thing I like to share is that when a woman gave birth, 1500s, 1600s, 1700s, when this was really at its zenith in our sort of Anglican history, but it has been popular in parallel religious traditions and parallel Christian traditions for far longer than that. It actually traces its roots all the way back to Judaism and Mary having her mikvah in Luke chapter 2. So her purification right before entering in the temple when they dedicate Jesus. We often skip over that, but that's actually mm-hmm. also part of what's happening. Is it's this moment to say, thank you, God, for delivering me from the perils of childbirth, especially in a time when childbirth killed a lot of people. And the fact that we've done away with it because we think modern medicine is like good enough, I just think is so dismissive of our reproductive stories. And the really powerful thing that is acknowledged actually in the introduction of Enriching Our Worship 5, this is very inside baseball. So if you're like, Lizzie, what are you talking about? See me after class. But Enriching Our Worship 5 is a liturgical resource that was put together specifically to deal with reproductive loss, joy, so miscarriage, an unexpected pregnancy, all sorts of prayers around that, is all sort of based off the churching of women, because women could be churched whether or not the child survived. And so it was an acknowledgement of what has happened to her and a time for her community to gather around her. And honestly, the Puritans hated it because women would use it as a big feast day, and they would like take off the work of mothering, and the dudes would take care of the babies, and they'd get righteously drunk and feast and then go to the church. And it was sort of the end of her maternity leave. So after a woman had had her lying in period for like 6 to 12 weeks, depending on her recovery or whatever, she would get up and go with all of her gossips, all of her besties, and get drunk and have a great time and go to church and have communion for the first time since giving birth. So there's lots of other ways it was interpreted. Puritans also saw it as like, you know, you have to cleanse women from the sin of childbirth, or, you know, there's lots of poor interpretations out there as well, but which is also why it died out. But I think its deepest intent is really beautiful. And so to answer this question, we church women at Jubilee. And if they want it, I offer that to them. And I have, it's actually a prayer book in the back that's from the 19th century that I bust out that we use for the churching of women. And I was churched, and I will be churched again. So
it is beautiful. I think there's so much there. So thank you for sharing that. And thank you for that question.
Yeah.
So we'll spend the rest of our time answering these other two questions, which are really wonderful. We got a question just kind of asking us to reflect on what our experience of recording the podcast has been like. And really, they're just curious about like, how's it going? And so thank you for asking. And honestly, it's just so amazing to reflect back on. This podcast had this dream like 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And it took a long time to figure out how to do it right. We're still figuring it out, by the way.
Learning also, new things Laura every day. Took so much grace and patience on your part because you reached out to me and were like, we should do this. And I was like, I would love to. And I can't right now, but like, don't forget me.
Yeah. No, we stayed in conversation and it kind of became more clear. And like, we really were starting from zero. Like, I just didn't know what I was doing or what this would entail. And so it just took a long time to talk to a lot of people and think through like what we really want it to be and really also listen to like what people were telling us, the kinds of resources that they wanted. And so we finally were able to launch it this fall and it's just been really generative and life-giving for my life.
So.
And to be able to talk about the things that we love the most, God and worshiping God and helping people worship God and connect with God is just such a privilege. And we both do it in our parish ministry. So like it's very much a part of our lives, but opening it up, having these conversations with more people has just been really, really powerful. And I'm so touched that what we're doing is connecting with people. Lizzie, what's it been like for you?
Well, it's been – there's so many things that I'm grateful for. I will start with sort of the outward and then move inward. Outwardly, I mean, we've had people come to church because of this podcast, and like that's always a joy. Mm-hmm. And Laura and I, to be very clear, we don't make the content we make online, be it silly TikTok sounds or, you know, or more serious podcasts because we want to like grow our empire or whatever. We do this because we genuinely want to offer resources for people who are looking to connect with God, perhaps and especially in a more liberative way than I think is often available in sort of the mass market. But also, it's really beautiful when people end up. I had some first-time guests during Holy Week who were like, yeah, I'm here because you talked about it on the podcast and I wanted to experience it. And I was like, that's incredible. Like, what a gift. So if that's you, thank you. It's been really a gift as a priest because I've used this. And this was always sort of my intent. Like, this was never, you know, a sort of, you know, bait and switch. But we've used it in our confirmation class. So I was like, there was one class where I was like, hey, listen to our baptism episode and then come in. We'll talk about it. And that was really cool. It's been really helpful to see that if people don't have the hour to stay on Sunday morning necessarily, it's not that they don't want to learn. It's just finding ways to meet people in that learning and honestly doubling the class time because then you've had the content and then you can just have the conversation on Sunday. So that's like really useful and cool and has been a really great way that we at Jubilee have been using the podcast. But also, Laura, it's just been really touching personally because like you and I will soon meet in person for our live event on Saturday, May 11th at Jubilee. Please come if you're in the area. Like for real, it's going to be great. But also, I'm laughing because I've been teasing Laura about some tricks I have up my sleeve. It's just been really a blessing to me to have these conversations with you because I get to have these kinds of conversations in parish ministry a lot, but I'm also solo clergy. And so to have someone to talk with through these things, it's a blessing to me personally and keeps me sharp, you know, like I think it's very easy for parish life to be consuming in the very important personnel and finance and HR and all that sort of stuff. And it's easy to kind of neglect the personal spirituality and the thinking about theology. And I feel like this has really kept me iron sharpening iron. I love talking with you and I love learning from our guests.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I had that reflection. Well, I think that a lot, like when we talk to our guests, they're just, they've been so thoughtful and wonderful. And I love hearing from other people and growing in my own faith in listening to what they have to share. But I have no clue if this is like a good metric or not. I mean, in my mind, like podcasts are either like the daily or like your friend's podcast you don't really want to listen to that much. I don't know. Like it's either like the most successful podcast or downloaded podcast or just like most of them aren't downloaded at all. I know that's not really how it is. But anyway, we just this week, and this will be airing several weeks later, so who knows, you know, where we'll be when you hear this. But just this week, we hit 30,000 downloads on our episodes, which is really feels like a lot to me. It feels like a significant number. And it,
yeah, I think it is a significant number.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it's certainly more downloads than I had at my church last year. The numbers don't really compare, but like, it's a big deal. And we've put a lot of effort into it, but also it's kind of like snowballing right now in a really neat way. Like, it's cool to see like the numbers inch up every week. And it's not all about the numbers, but to me, what they say is that this is connecting with people.
Yeah,
and
it's doing what
you are sharing this with people. Like, you know, if we have a Patreon, and if you're interested in supporting us, because this actually does cost money, we have software and we have an editor, and there's just other kind of random expenses that go along with it. So if you're interested in supporting, we really would love you to check out our Patreon page. It's linked in our Instagram. But also, like, just, you know, if you write us a review somewhere on Apple or Spotify, if you review the podcast, even that helps. If you share our silly memes,
seriously,
and if you follow us on Instagram, like, all of that stuff matters and has helped us get the word out there, because there are a lot of people who are looking for a resource like this, and that's why we've made it. And it kind of just broadens the conversation when more people are listening. Like, we're getting more questions and more, you know, emails and that kind of stuff. And that, it's just so neat to see.
I'm so glad you brought up emails, Laura, because even though we are not the best at responding to them, we read everything, y'all. And your emails have like broken and blessed my heart. And I mean that in the best, as an Enneagram 4, that's like such a compliment. Like, truly, I am blown away and like terrified, humbled, amazed. The friend who shared that she was baptized after listening to her baptism episode, reading your email and seeing your pictures, I wept.
So like, powerful. So powerful. Touched.
So thank you. And thank you all for your feedback and your questions. And it means the world to us, because like, I just know, because I've been the person looking for these resources, and I am the person frantically as a priest trying to connect people to resources of like, they are out there, right? But like, when you walk into your average bookstore, or you go to the, you know, Amazon top 20 list or whatever, it's not always a liberative, inclusive, empowering, gentle vision of Christianity. And we really passionately believe that that is who God is and what God calls us to do. And so thank you for being evangelists for this message. It means a lot. We really do treasure all of your stories.
Yeah. And also, we are just open to where it will go in the future too. Like, we are wrapping up season one right now, and starting to think about season two. And we kind of have an idea of where we're going, although we don't know. You know, we're open to where this leads, where the Spirit leads. Like, it's just exciting to see things kind of organically emerging as things we want to incorporate. So, yeah, it just to reflect back on the whole experience, it's just been wonderful. It's just really, really been a blessing. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Lizzie and I are both full-time priests and parents and spouses and, you know, whatever. We're all busy people. I get that. But this is not our job. And so, like, to stack this on everything else kind of feels – it's hard sometimes. But the other part of that is it's always good. You know, there have been some episodes where I'm like, man, I wish I could have been more prepared or whatever. But I listen to them back and I think, no. What needed to be said was said. And listening back to our episodes, I'm blessed by the things that you, Lizzie, and that our guests contribute. So,
yeah, I am also really excited down the line. I'm trying not to talk too much about it, but I do have a book coming out next year. And it's been a real blessing to me in my creative process in writing it. And I'm going to reference several episodes in this podcast. And it's nice to have like something to reference in a footnote and say, this is where we had this conversation. But it's also really cool because I think we've been very intentional in who we've invited on here. Like, some folks, of course, have established platforms and published books and are known, but we've been pretty intentional about asking people who we know are either new scholars or don't have that big of a platform, or are people we know from real ministry who are really like doing this thing, not just talking about doing it online. And it's been just really formative and nourishing, and nourishing to know that we're not just doing this by ourselves. So, mm-hmm.
So thank you for listening.
Thank you. Seriously. Well, we have one more question, don't we, Laura?
Yeah. Yeah. I was wrapping up that question and getting us ready for the next one.
Okay. I'm ready.
This was a question someone asked us on Instagram, and they said, best advice for new Episcopalians. And what a good question.
Oh, okay. I have a question first in response that I have to give credit to the Reverend David Wantland. I love you, David. I hope you're well, wherever you are. David was my confirmation teacher when I was going through the confirmation process in the Episcopal Church. Of course, I went through confirmation while I was in divinity school, so David was also my classmate at Duke, but just like such a wonderful, fantastic Episcopal priest. And he asked something that I now ask in all of my confirmation classes. And I just treasured because I felt when I first came into the Episcopal Church that I had to basically denounce and renounce everything I'd been before.
Yes.
And I think this is a shadow side often of our denomination, that it's like we really think we're the smartest and the brightest and the best, and we're the boutique. You know, we're like, not everybody knows who we are because like we're exclusive, and I don't like that. And that's why we're making this podcast, because it's like, guys, we're trying not to be exclusive. Okay. But especially coming from a Methodist and more evangelical background, that was often really like scorned and disdained. And he asked, what from your previous faith communities, from your denominational upbringing, from the churches you've been worshiping at before, what do you want to bring with you into your spiritual life here at this church and into the Episcopal Church? Because as you become part of the Episcopal Church, you become part of it. All of your story, everything that you experience and bring. And I think that's like such a powerful question, because so many folks, speaking from experience, when we are deconstructing or walking out of something that was really toxic or painful, right? Or harmful, you know, we just want to denounce the whole thing, right? And actually like denouncing the whole thing and whole scale, you know, I hate this phrase, throwing the baby out with the bathwater, right? But like, that's not actually sufficiently healing or decolonizing or recognizing that like God was still there, right? Like God is still present in churches whose theology I find reprehensible. God is still preaching and teaching and loving and healing and liberating in churches that would never acknowledge me as a priest. Because if I say that God isn't, then I have made God in my own image. And so my first question back to you is, if you're a new Episcopalian, and even if you're like, I've literally never, like I've just been an atheist my whole life, or I've never was part of a church, anything. Mm-hmm. Well, you've still, God was still around you. Like what of that life do you want to bring into this community and into your faith life? Because
yes,
that's still precious. So that's my first thought. Laura, what's your first thought?
Yeah. Oh, Lizzie, I really just value that perspective so much because I experience it so much in my ministry too. Hello, wonderful people of St. Paul's who are listening. Yes. many of you were not raised in the Episcopal Church. I mean, we have an episode with my rector coming out this season, but he estimates that only 25% of my parish was raised Episcopalian. So 75% of us were raised in different churches or no church or come from some other place and have now found a home in the Episcopal Church. And so a lot, but it's interesting because there's so much anxiety about doing things right and fitting in and being Episcopalian enough. And yet the majority of us are not Episcopalian enough, you know, like it's
and that's kind the of future of the church, like future Episcopalians listening, the days of, oh, well, so-and-so who moved from out of town. Like I think Ethan was saying this recently. It's like,
No.
People who are joining the Episcopal Church are either atheist, agnostics, or from other traditions by and large.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He was commenting like your new members aren't going to be, you know, people who just moved to town for the most part. So there's a lot of anxiety and wondering about like how, what am I doing right or wrong or all that. And, you know, I felt that for a long time too, honestly, up until I was ordained and even past that, like
often
I'm wondering like, am I Episcopalian enough? And like many people would say, absolutely not.
Yeah, plenty.
I'm an ordained priest in this denomination and I've taken vows to it and to God. And so maybe I'm fine. Maybe I'm enough. I'm not really that worried about that anymore, because now when I think about being Episcopalian enough, whatever that means, I think, well, you know what? I've been a Christian my whole life and I've been experiencing God my whole life. And I have just all of these years of experience, of knowledge, of whatever to draw on. And to me, like, the Episcopal Church is great. Obviously, that is what I believe because this is the church I'm, you know, ordained in and employed by. But I am much more interested in being a follower, a disciple of Jesus than I am a disciple of the Episcopal Church. And we talked about this a little bit in our What Is Church episode, or we will talk about it. But I think the church is a great way to worship God and to gather. I believe that truly. But when I feel anxious about not being Episcopalian enough, I'm like, where, why, what is that? You know, what is that serving? How is that helping my ministry? And it's not really. But I think it's fine to be curious and to want to learn more about the particulars of this denomination. Like, don't get me wrong. I'm not writing any of that off, but I also just want to join Lizzie in really encouraging you to think about the gifts you bring rather than what you might lack.
Yeah. And like, because I too often have these moments of like, particularly given that my Anglican year, which is the year of like Episcopal finishing school to like really make me Episcopalian, was interrupted by a pandemic. And my early years of ministry were during the pandemic, and now I'm a vicar. So it's like, which means solo clergy. So I, you know, have of course lots of resources and family and friends, including Laura, who I can call being like, what do I do with this again? But it's, usually I find when I'm like, am I not Episcopalian enough? It's like, am I not a particular demographic? And actually the Episcopal Church is really vast and diverse. And I just remember what Reverend Ryan Hawthorne said way back on our What Is Eucharist episode of like, there's a myth that the Episcopal Church is like white, upper class, wealthy. Like, yeah, that is historically, but that's not the reality of most Episcopalians in the world. And so remember that and ask yourself, who is the image that I'm trying to cast myself into? And all that being said, we're never going to leave you without a few practical tips because we understand. So I will share this. This is what I share with all of my new folks that I learned in Catholic catechism as a 7-year-old is that if you're in a congregation where there's a lot of sitting and standing and maybe kneeling, we would do a lot more kneeling at Jubilee, but we don't have kneelers. And so we have cushions that I bring out, especially for Lent and Holy Week when I'm like, okay, I really want to make sure that like we have legit option for kneeling. But, if you're in a church that has a lot of sitting, standing, kneeling, and you're like, when do I sit? When do I stand? What do I? Just follow the priest. Just follow the priest. And if the priest is standing, you should probably stand if you want, if you feel so led. If the priest is sitting, you can probably sit. The main exception to this is the sermon. Usually the priest is the only one standing for the sermon. So, and usually if they're doing their job right, they will say, please be seated. This wonderful poet, Jay Hume, I'm going to do a very bad British accent. I'm so sorry. But when he came to preach at Jubilee, he was like, do sit down. I was so charmed by
so British.
So cute.
So Lizzie, what I will say to challenge that answer, which I actually do agree with very much so.
Oh no, but we're all about the via media here. We're all about discourse. Yeah.
So at my church, there can be 3 or 4 priests up front and we don't all do the same thing. And
I love that.
That is something that I think we really value. We don't all cross ourselves at the same time. We mostly bow at the same time just because like it looks a little sloppy if you're not. But
yeah, for sure.
There are many parts in the service where we are not doing the same thing. And that is okay. And I think a really healthy picture of the church. Like we don't all have to be doing the same thing, but we're doing it together. And there's something beautiful about that. So yes, do you know, watch and ask, but also I want to say there's really no wrong way to do it. Yeah, maybe don't stand during the sermon, but if you have to, whatever.
I mean, there's usually someone standing at some point in my sermon to hold a baby or rock a baby or, you know, go to the bathroom or whatever. And I do, I'm glad you pointed that. One, I agree with you. And I'm like, I want to clarify that there are certain gestures that priests do that the laity are like not like when we bless people. So we hold our hand out and we like make the open handed sign of the cross. That's a time for you to cross yourself if you so desire. Right. So I'm not saying mimic every single thing that the priest does.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Right. I'm more talking about the sitting, the standing and the kneeling, like the sort of moves.
But I love and you can always ask.
You can always ask
like, what about that? You know, when do I do that? It depends what mood you get me in. Some days I'll be like, whenever you want. I don't, but I mean, there is a theology behind when people bow at the cross or when they cross themselves or and it's beautiful. And honestly, what I would say, I'm not dismissive of those things. I would say learn what they are and then try out different stuff and do what feels right to you. Like how in your body, how do you honor God? If bowing is a sign of that, then like, please bow, like, please do that. But if it's something that doesn't really connect with you and God, then you don't have to do it. It's okay.
Right. Right. I take a really deep bow before the altar every time we process in or process out or when we come to the gospel. And that's partially my piety of like just taking a moment and bowing before God. And also it has a very practical purpose. And then it just gives me a second. It just gives me a second where it's like,
yeah, it's not always that deep.
It's not that deep. And also it's like when I bow before the cross at the start of the service, I've done the announcements to welcome everybody, which I often feel the most anxiety about because it's not scripted and, you know, chaos is ensuing usually with my child running around. But it's like a centering of me into worship, putting my body into a posture of worship. And also remembering it's like, if my sermon sucks and if I mess up everything that's about to happen, if I trip over my words at every part of the service, it's not about me. It's about God. Like, thank God. And so that's why I do a really deep bow. And so, And another thing is anytime there's a Trinitarian formula, which is a fancy way of saying, if we say Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, or something that refers to the Trinity. So love, beloved, and love itself. I think, I can't remember. Do you know this one? There's like one that's really popular. That's
That's what I've heard.
Yeah. Creator, Redeemer, Sustainer. Anything that sort of calls upon like the name of God as Trinity. That's I would say particularly appropriate moment to cross yourself if you want to or feel led to. And then I think more broad, do you have any other like Laura, like broad speaking, you're new to the Episcopal Church things?
Yeah, like, I do.
Not just like liturgy or worship related.
Yeah, I think we're really speaking to like what it feels like to be in a service, a worship service, but obviously there's a lot more to being part of the church. I mean, part of – it's interesting. Like different churches understand – membership differently. My church doesn't hold on to that so tightly, to be honest. And I really agree with that theologically.
Yes. And frankly, I think most of us are revisiting that concept post-pandemic or like, you know, in the phase of the pandemic we're in. Cause like, how do you measure people who worship with you on live stream every week, but you never see in person? And so
it's
like a church-wide conversation. Right.
I think in the Episcopal Church, it's, you know, our churches often have, sometimes they're called different things, but vestries, there are lay, our parishes have lay people who are responsible for the church. I mean, yes, there's a priest in charge or rector or, you know, there's clergy who are running things, but we very much believe that the church is lay run as well. So part of that too is like just learning about what that means. Like there are people you can talk to when you have, you know, questions, comments, concerns. And also it's an interesting structure of what it means to be part of a church. And, you know, there's often giving that accompanies that. And I'm sorry, I'm being a little bit vague because it really does take different shape in different particular parishes. But what I'm trying to say is I encourage you to sit down with your priest or your senior warden or someone in leadership in the parish and ask them, like, how does this church run? What does it mean to be here and part of this community? And what does this community need from me as I'm part of it? And they'll tell you. And there are all sorts of different needs. And so I just really want to encourage you to just jump in. And I know it's really overwhelming sometimes. So I'm encouraging you in that, but like learn more about this church and this community and know like what we talked about at the beginning of this question, like that you bring stuff, wisdom and knowledge and gifts.
Yeah. And I think it's a vast tradition, but I'll leave with two things, one very practical and one more theological. So practically, just because I realize we've been saying this a lot and we've not necessarily clarified in a while, in the Episcopal Church, the ordained people, so the people who are usually wearing some kind of clergy collar, right? So the white collar that goes all the way around the neck or the tab. There's no difference between those two. It's just like personal preference. Those are usually either deacons, priests, or bishops. And you can tell bishops because they're in purple. And bishops are the boss. And bishops oversee a whole region, which we call a diocese. But you've heard Laura and I say things like rector and vicar and clergy. So clergy is anyone who's ordained. So clergy is actually like an interfaith term. So a rabbi is also a clergy person. An imam is also a clergy person. A Methodist pastor is clergy. So all Episcopal clergy, aka all Episcopal deacons, priests, and bishops are clergy. Mm-hmm. And anyone who is an Episcopal priest, you know they're a priest because they wear a stole, which is basically like a really long scarf. It's actually, it kind of comes from the towel Jesus wears around his neck when he washes the feet of the disciples. So they wear it like over the neck. So you see two pieces, deacons wear them sideways, or they wear a chasuble because they're the presider or the celebrant. But you can have multiple priests at a church who fulfill different roles. And so the term rector or vicar refers to the head of the congregation. So that's a job. It's not an ordination term. So mm-hmm. I am a vicar, which literally means vicarious for the bishop, which is kind of fun. And you'll hear that a lot more in like Great Britain and like former British colonies of like vicar is more commonly used. It's not very common in the United States. I can always tell though, I get asked a lot when I'm around town if I'm a vicar, and it's always from people who've like moved here from Australia very consistently. Mm. That's happened to me like three times in the last month. I was like, wow, okay. But vicar is like because my church is a church plant, we're new. I'm the head of the congregation, but I'm vicarious for the bishop. Whereas Laura's boss is a rector, and that's not like a special ordination. That's just like his job title. So
mm-hmm. Yeah, he's
just want to clarify that.
Served there. Yeah, there's a lot of terms that Episcopalians will use, and even between different churches, there'll be different names for things that are the same often thing. Very similar. Yeah.
Right.
So feel free to always ask. It's never like an unwanted thing. Like I'm always happy when people ask questions and seek clarity. But yeah, I think our advice is practical, theological, and welcome.
Yeah. And this leads to the theological thing I want to leave with, which if that's all super confusing, like we are a denomination very genuinely that really values questions. And I say that even as I picture some of my kindred who I haven't always gotten along with, like every Episcopal church I've ever been a part of, like we value questions. There is space for you to be confused. Mm-hmm. There's space for you to have doubt. There's space for you to push back. There's space for you to wonder. And there's actually a lot of structural things in place, which is part of what Laura was talking about with vestries. My church, we call it a bishop's committee because we're a church plant. So we have to have everything that's like mm-hmm. directly under the bishop, which is actually also like a legal thing as well, like a federal law thing. Yeah. Anyway, a whole other conversation another time. But we have structures in place to actually protect people asking questions and to encourage you to see that, like, this is not the kind of, you know, there's certainly, we don't get everything right. And there's certainly reckoning that is happening and coming for people who have done harm. And I do really believe that our structure, like our polity, is one where people who worship in these communities who don't have an MDiv, who are not ordained, like really do have a very strong voice in leadership. And that's not true in every church that you would walk into. So, and your priest really mm-hmm. cares what you think and that you feel welcome. And we're really glad that you want to be Episcopalian.
Yeah. And my one last thing would be, it could be really interesting to flip through the Book of Common Prayer and look at what's there, right? Some of the prayer services, maybe your church already gathers and does that. You could join them. You know, look at the kinds of things that we pray and talk about in our denomination, because the Book of Common Prayer is unique to the Episcopal Church and is a gift. And it's a reordering. We have a whole episode on it, so without, you know, repeating all of that, but it's kind of a organizing and reordering of scripture. So to serve prayer in our life of prayer. So I would just say flip through it and give it a go and try it out, because it's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. Well, thank you for your questions, everyone.
Yeah.
We're feeling like very thankful and just honored. And I don't know. It's been such a great ride. And I love seeing the questions you guys ask. And some of them we kind of we're coming back to them. Okay. So yeah, thank
if we
you.
Didn't if
you submitted
get your
a
question,
yeah.
Fret not.
We'll get back to it. Yeah. One way or another. But happy Easter and thank you all for being here and listening. And Lizzie, the Lord be with you.
And also with you.